This podcast is for professional investors only. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to Elgin Talks. It's been an important few weeks in the biodiversity space as representatives of 196 countries gathered in Colombia for COP16, the world's largest biodiversity summit. It was 2 years ago at COP15 when governments struck a historic deal to halt the destruction of ecosystems. So COP16 had some pretty big boots to fill. But what actually happened at the summit and what could it mean for the planet and investors? Here with me today are two nature and climate experts in our investment stewardship team, Alex Burr, ESG policy lead, and Toby McKean, ESG analyst. Alex and Toby flew out to Colombia for the summit and will be sharing their on-the-ground perspectives to help us navigate the event and its potential impact. Thank you for joining me, guys.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So, first of all, there's quite a few different COPs out there, so it'd be great to get a bit of an education. What is COP16 and what did it set out to achieve?
Thanks, June. Yeah, you're quite right. We have what has been termed the Rio Trio this year. So we have three different COPs, one being the Global Biodiversity COP or Nature Summit. We have obviously the Climate COP coming up at the end of November. And then we move on to the desertification in Saudi, which is another COP16. The COP which we've just attended is the one which is focused on nature more broadly. There was 20, 30,000 people there, but there was senior level representation from across the private and public sector. And these people aren't just flying into Colombia just to have a discussion about the environment, but this is really setting the rules and reforming how we work with nature and interact with nature, and really starting to shift that capital towards something which we are not worsening the situation for, not continuing to degrade our environment, and essentially how we mitigate this huge potential, huge risk which is coming facing us if we don't.
So COP16 obviously follows COP15, which you alluded to, June, and at COP15 we saw the agreement of the Global Biodiversity Framework, and the real purpose of COP16 was kind of regarded as this implementation COP to really use as a sort of status check on how we are progressing against that Global Biodiversity Framework and the 23 targets and 4 goals that were agreed on in COP15. So that was that's the sort of key aim of COP16.
Great, thank you. So moving on to my next question, why was this summit so important and why now? What is the backdrop to this and what situation do we find ourselves in right now in terms of a nature and biodiversity angle?
Many of us will know nature is in rapid decline. WWF has estimated that since 1970, we've lost 70% of wildlife populations, and there are projections that by 2050, there'll be more plastic in the sea than marine animals. It highlights that our relationship with nature is unequal. We can't simply keep extracting the benefits which we receive from nature, so the natural assets and the ecosystem services that we receive and all of our economies rely on. So if we're serious about the future of the stability of our economies, we must see COP16 as a real turning point where we start to understand the true value of preserving our natural world.
So as I mentioned, COP15 resulted in a groundbreaking new deal. So perhaps there were some high expectations of COP16. What was actually achieved at the summit, or what was agreed this time round, and what were the key outcomes?
I think there's a lot going on in COP16. If we start with finance, which was a really, really big focus for this year's COP, there's a lot of things to unpack within that. So there's the funding gap we have at a global scale and what governments are contributing to some of the financing facilities which were agreed in the GBF in Montreal. And financing gap, we're looking at sort of 700 billion. And the level of contributions at the moment from governments is way below that. We're looking at millions. So at COP16, I think there was about 163 million contributed in addition to what is already within the fund. So that's significantly below what we need and what we're looking to achieve. So that's on the public side. But then there was a lot of work and a lot of discussion about what the private sector's doing, both from a business and investor perspective. There was a lot of discussion around nature data, and I'd like to pass to Toby to give us an update on those areas, because it's a really important area which we have been focusing on for some time under our nature framework and our nature strategy. So let me hand to Toby.
As you said, Alex, beyond maybe some of the kind of shortcomings in the negotiations around resource mobilization, monitoring frameworks, I think the discussion that was happening in the sort of private sector, business, finance communities was perhaps slightly more encouraging. And maybe I can just pull out some of the positive elements of what was happening on the ground. But I guess there are three I'll focus on. The first is this significant momentum that's building to kind of address this in across the corporate landscape. And one of the high profile announcements through COP was the adoption of TNFD. And we now have over 500 adopters of the TNFD, so the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, which is a 57% increase since January 2024. So it's a really encouraging kind of recognition of nature as this critical factor in business risk and opportunity, but also in terms of how they're looking to manage their impact. Second one is, as you mentioned, around this data and metric evolution, essentially. And this is a real challenge that's often cited when we're talking about corporate level or FI level approaches to nature. But there has been a huge amount of progress. And if we look back in the 2 years since we were both out in Montreal, the conversations and the granularity of what we're talking about in and around data and metrics has progressed hugely. So a hurdle in the last 2 years has been asset level or geolocational level data. We now have, you know, very good data sets that we can start to work with at various different levels. There's interesting innovations in eDNA, satellite data, etc., which are really fueling the discussion. Important to recognize there are still hurdles. Because there has been so much attention on it, there is a risk of even more fragmentation of data sources. And there's still this really important need to standardize it, especially at the sort of level that we interact with it all. And then the third I'll just pull out is around transition planning. And this is, again, something that's gained a huge momentum in recent years, building off the kind of dialogue in the climate space. And it's really part of this movement to fundamentally shift business models away from what is business as usual into alignment with much more attractive future scenarios that we're all trying to work towards. And as I said previously, transition planning is a concept that sort of came out of the climate discussions and moving beyond TCFD, which is predominantly a sort of risk-based disclosure framework. What we're seeing is now the sort of broadening out of transition planning discussion to integrate nature more holistically. So how do you actually move your business model in line with these kind of breadth of systemic risks that we're facing across climate and nature? And there are a couple of announcements. TNFD released their own transition plan guidance. We saw one from GFANS. The Transition Plan Task Force has been feeding into those that we've sort of been working closely with. So yeah, that was a really positive step forward as well in the private discussion.
But there was one area which I wanted to draw back to on the public financing side, which is an area which was mentioned in Montreal, but it really felt like there was an increased focus this year at COP16. It was around reforming existing subsidy programs or government programs which are negatively impacting nature. We've done a lot of work on this with a collaborative group on the FAIR in the agricultural space. These are huge programs, right? We're talking trillions. There's no logic behind the existing systems worsening or impacting nature negatively, being environmentally harmful, which is working against what we're all trying to achieve here. So it points to a bit more coordinated domestic policymaking, which is not there right now and really needs to accelerate. There are, of course, huge challenges within that. You know, subsidy programs, even in agriculture, are vastly different and warranted in some senses across markets. And they do take different forms. There's not one specific subsidy program which you could identify. There's a multitude of them. So it is challenging, but we're taking that discussion forward, including engaging with the G20 on that. So it was really encouraging to hear that was being raised up the agenda within COP.
That's been really useful to hear. I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about headlines in the media. So there have been some critical headlines as to the so-called success of COP16. But hearing from your on-the-ground experiences of actually being at the summit and being involved in these conversations, clearly, Alex, as you say, there's been an increased focus in meaningful areas, and there's been some real evolution and progress. So I wanted to ask, what was your verdict of COP16 overall? Would you say it was a success?
I think if we didn't work in this space and be slightly optimistic, then we wouldn't be in this space for very long. These are challenging topics. These are challenging long-term topics, which take a long time to shift. And there's politics within all of it as well. So to have that change and success at every COP, it's unlikely to happen. There were some really positive things which came out of COP16. There were, of course, things which we need to look at again. But to stick on the positives, there was a really interesting piece around digital sequencing information. And there was the creation, as you may have heard, something called the Cali Fund, which is looking to really provide some financing back to those markets, those biodiverse markets, which are providing that genetic sequencing to, for example, pharmaceutical companies and those which are benefiting from that. It is, as expected, voluntary contributions at the moment, and it's this sort of innovative view on a levy. But it's an interesting way to look at how businesses can contribute additionally to where they're receiving benefits from nature. Where they're actually using the natural assets and bringing that sort of value point back. So that was a really positive outcome. Another, which I think was very positive, was so there's bringing Indigenous rights into the official negotiations. That was really prominent within discussions. As we walked around the Blue Zone, there was a lot of engagement from Indigenous peoples, and that's really important because that is a group which has been stewarding these protected areas or biodiversity rich areas for generations. So bringing them in more formally into the negotiations is an important step.
On the ground, I think was really interesting to hear the kind of urgency that they brought to the conversation. And I think, you know, at the level we're talking on, as you say, there's this big slow moving policy environment that we're all working in, whereas you know, the on the ground stewards of the environment bring an urgency to the dialogue, and having that mix of opinions and discussions was amazing to hear. And there was one quote that sticks with lots of us, I think, from one of the sessions where representatives said very, very clearly that we're eating the planet that is feeding us. And I thought that just really brought home the conversation and what we're all focusing towards.
There was one other area which perhaps got a little bit less headlines because it was a more practical, or it was a very specific point. It was around agreeing protected areas in oceans, and something which will go forward and support then the ratification for the High Seas Treaty, which is going through the process. We don't have sufficient numbers yet on the ratification, which is always difficult.
Yeah. Maybe I just pick up on a couple of points you said, but the digital sequencing piece and what was known as the Cali Fund, as you're referring to, I think conceptually is a really important and interesting development of, as exactly as you said, Alex, of sort of rethinking our relationship with nature. So it's although it's kind of framed in the language as maybe slightly weak and a voluntary exercise in companies paying for the services that they are gaining from nature. It's, as I said, conceptually very interesting that companies are now, the discussion is going towards paying for those services. So as revaluing how we, our relationship with nature. So I think that's a really interesting development, although perhaps weak in practice.
If you look at the more challenging areas, I think we're both very aware of, or everybody is very aware about finance side, as we've touched on, but there's also that policy piece and the monitoring piece and the progress we're achieving. So similar to that of the climate space, governments and policymakers are expected to submit essentially their strategies and updates. So something called a National Biodiversity Action Plan. And I think 44 out of the 126 parties of the
196.
It is only submitted these NBSAPs. So that was a real frustration. We have more time for them to submit that, but there's a real urgency for them to get on and explain what they're doing across their economies to meet these targets and goals of the GBF.
Although I think we've been right to focus on some of the positives, but there have been global targets on biodiversity before that were called the Aichi targets, and those, put simply, were a complete failure, and we didn't make any progress towards achieving those targets. And I think it's well agreed that one of the reasons we didn't was this lack of a monitoring framework, both at the international level, but then also in terms of national plans and accountability within those and making progress on them. So I think if we are to highlight one area where COP16 needs to make progress in terms of the intersessional discussions that will follow it, making progress on a monitoring framework is really important.
So that actually ties in quite nicely with my next question. So as you both know, the summit itself is not the finishing line, and this will be a continuing piece of work. How do you measure ongoing progress on something like this in a meaningful way? How do you keep track of what was agreed and discussed at the summit and monitor the progress in the continuing months and years? For example, you mentioned government strategies. How do you guys keep a track of ongoing progress?
Yeah, that's a really important point, and sort of speaks back to how we approach nature as a topic as well. So we, about last year, I think we released our nature framework, which outlines four different areas of which we're focused on, or four themes. So we have circular economy, deforestation, water, and something we call natural capital management. And we attribute those to those five direct drivers of nature change. And within each of those, we are very focused on both corporate engagement, but then that wider stakeholder policy environment too. So we are very attuned and monitoring closely progress across each market and each of those spaces. So deforestation, for example, we're engaging heavily with the UK government and the EU with regards to the policy which is being developed there, so the EU deforestation regulation at the moment. And then within water, you know, that's a really, like, can be a very large area, so it covers fresh water and the marine environment. And there's a lot of international negotiation going on at the moment, high seas treaties, removing some of those fishing subsidies. And then if we look to something actually which is going on at the moment under circular economy, it's negotiations around the Global Plastics Treaty, with the next round of negotiations coming up at the end of the month. So it's all happening. And that will form the basis of a really sort of hopefully very ambitious treaty to curb our plastic use going forward. So we are engaging in these topics, both from a sort of corporate and policy angle. And how we monitoring progress is something which we do on a sort of daily basis.
You know, clearly monitoring progress at an international national level is very, very challenging. And what we're trying to do is push progress as fast as possible through both that policy level dialogue, but also in the companies that we are invested in. And as you've mentioned, Alex, we have a sub-theme called natural capital management, which acts as this sort of underpinning element of the various aspects of our nature strategy, nature framework. And it's really as a sub-theme there to capture the work we're doing to strengthen globally how companies are assessing, integrating and disclosing their interactions with nature, as well as developing this sort of enabling environment that supports them to do that. And as a sub-theme, it acknowledges the current lack of market maturity in addressing all of this and how they understand their risks, opportunities, impacts, and dependencies. And it also reflects where perhaps we as a large global investor can have the most impact in engaging and supporting the development of this area. And then ultimately our access to more decision useful information to develop the way that we're building investment strategies and this flow of private capital that we've talked about earlier.
So what do you think needs to happen over the next few weeks, months and years post COP16 now? You mentioned the Global Plastics Treaty. That could be one thing. Are there any specific kind of goals, actions you'll be watching out for?
Yeah, well, I guess I can be specific on two. The first is the national action plans. So this was a real shortcoming, as Alex alluded to, in the lead up and during COP, the sort of lack of national level implementation and planning. So that's something that needs to be addressed very, very quickly to produce the sort of policy and enabling environment for companies and the finance world to make the progress we need. So that would be the first thing. And then the second is a bit more specific, but building on this transition planning element and the sort of important aspect for us here is that companies are supporting this system shift that we've been referring to. And in order to do that, there are various elements of transition plan guidance that are being kind of created, and we will be feeding into various consultations on those. But there is a sort of danger of a slight proliferation in guidance that's out there. And we tread this very delicate line between overburdening corporates in terms of their reporting obligations versus making tangible progress to shift their business models to more sustainable models. So that's something that we'll be picking up more specifically off the back of COP.
Great, thank you very much. And my last question for you is, what role can investors like Elgin play to help in all of this and keep that progress continuing?
So like we said earlier, we as a firm have identified nature as a systemic market risk, like we have done for climate and health and other key topics. We have laid out our approach, our strategy to supporting achieving the Global Biodiversity Framework. And we've done that in a quite structured way across the thematic topics. We are engaging on each of those topics across the sort of policy and corporate space. We have, as Toby mentioned, we are influencing and working with corporates which we are invested with. This is a new topic to some, it's not so new to others. So it's improving their understanding on where their risks and dependencies lie and their impacts, and helping them shift to work in a way which they understand and value nature. And within that, also with policymakers, you know, we hope that they are engaged in the topic. I mean, we've seen that with 196 signatories to the GBF. So it's keeping that ongoing policy dialogue, that ongoing corporate dialogue on these key topics where we feel we can have material impact on.
There are various global biodiversity framework targets for 2030. There are even a few for 2025. And those are coming very, very quickly. And what we're talking about is a huge shift in the relationship we have with our natural environment, which is no small thing. And the policy level dialogue is moving, but not at a pace which it needs to. And there is a really, really important role for big global investors like LGIM to push forward that discussion. And I think throughout the conversation, we've highlighted various aspects in which we're doing that.
So really vital work, and you've both got quite a lot on your plate, clearly. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. So thank you both for unpicking this complex but incredibly important topic.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of Legal & General Investment Management Limited, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for information purposes only, and we are not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general economic, market or political issues and/or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not an offer or recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against Legal & General in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this document contains third-party information, the accuracy and completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person resident in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulation. Copyright 2024. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. In Hong Kong, this material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on X, formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.